United States Court of Appeals for Veterans Claims is now in session. The Honorable Margaret Bartley presiding. God bless the United States and this honorable court.
Good afternoon. I'm Judge Bartley, and I'm joined today via video conference by Judge Peach and Judge Laurer. We're here for the matter of Jose F. Rivera Colon versus Dennis McDonough, Secretary of Veterans Affairs, docket number 19-6129. Counsel for the parties, please state your name and your appearance for the record, beginning with appellant's counsel.
Please the court, Kenneth Carpenter appearing on behalf of Mr. Jose Rivera Colon, also appearing as Mr. Javier Santanzio.
Thank you, Mr. Carpenter and Mr. Santanzio. And secretary's counsel?
May it please the court, Carson Garand with Christopher Wallace on behalf of the secretary.
Thank you, Mr. Garand and Mr. Wallace. Each party has 30 minutes to present argument. Mr. Carpenter, you would like to reserve 10 minutes?
Yes, Your Honor.
That's fine. We will make that happen. And you may proceed, Mr. Carpenter, when you're ready.
May it please the court, Kenneth Carpenter appearing on behalf of Mr. Rivera Colon. There are two issues we would like to address this morning or this afternoon's argument. The first is whether or not the issue of extra scheduler consideration was reasonably raised by the record. And second, if the issue was reasonably raised, what is the appropriate remedy under the amended version of 38 CFR 3.321B1? In regards to the first issue, we believe that this court's decision in Berenger, as was argued by Mr. Rivera Colon in his opening brief, is controlled by this court's case in Berenger versus Peek. The question before the court in that case is the same as the question in this court, which is whether or not, in this matter, whether or not the board erred in not discussing or addressing whether or not the veteran's disability warranted referral for extra scheduler evaluation. In Berenger, the court relied upon this court's decision in Thun, recognizing that although the board may not assign a extra scheduler rating in the first instance, that extra scheduler rating must be specifically adjudicated as to whether or not to refer the case for extra scheduler consideration when either the issue is raised by the claimant specifically or is reasonably raised by the evidence of record. It is the latter which applies in this case. The potential applicability, this court in Berenger concluded that the evidence of record did in fact reasonably raise the potential applicability and that it was clear error for the board not to have discussed it. That is the same error that was made by the board in this case. The secretary presents a post hoc rationalization that the functional effects of Mr. Rivera Colon's gastritis disability did not reasonably raise the issue of whether or not referral was warranted. But the secretary makes his arguments based upon the diagnostic code that covers his symptoms and argues that Mr. Rivera Colon did not demonstrate how the rating schedule was inadequate. These arguments are without merit because the issue in this appeal is not whether or not Mr. Rivera Colon was entitled to extra scheduler consideration. The issue in this matter is whether or not the board erred, as the board did in Berenger, when it failed to discuss or address whether or not the evidence reasonably raised the issue.
Mr. Carpenter.
Yes, John.
I know that in Berenger, there was evidence that the veteran wasn't able to work due to the service-connected condition. There was frequent hospitalization, several incidents of hospitalization, and some evidence of severe symptoms. So what are the factual predicates here that you're relying on that you're saying are kind of like Berenger that would put him in that category?
Well, specifically as relied upon in the opening brief is the medical report, which recorded the difficulty that Mr. Colon was having with his service-connected disability in preventing him from being able to work. That is clearly sufficient evidence for the board to have recognized that the question of extra scheduler consideration was warranted because of the clear correlation between the service-connected disability and his difficulty in being able to work because of that disability.
Now, the first thing that would pop into my mind when I hear, you know, having difficulty working due to a service-connected condition is a TDIU type issue.
And I agree, Your Honor, and to be perfectly candid, had I been briefing this matter, that would have been the issue that I would have raised. The issue, however, that was raised by appellant's counsel was whether or not the same issue, the same evidence also reasonably raised the extra scheduler consideration. And I think that was done in this case by appellant's counsel because the scheduler rating did not meet the scheduler requirements for triggering 4.16A. And therefore, I believe it was assumed that it would be more appropriate to raise it under 3.321B1. However, at the at page 12 of the Secretary's brief, the Secretary acknowledges that Mr. Rivera's opening brief relied upon three specific pieces of evidence which reasonably raised the issue. So it seems to me that that issue has been conceded by the government in their brief, and the question is merely now, what is the appropriate remedy because it was reasonably raised? The Secretary's reliance upon this court's decision in Long is misplaced because this court's decision in Long dealt with the criteria required for referral and not the issue of reasonably raised, which is the issue in this appeal. If the court has no further questions on the first issue, I would like to proceed to the question of remedy. Yeah,
Mr. Carpenter?
Yes, Your Honor.
I have a couple of questions. You mentioned that the appellant had raised three pieces of evidence to support the argument that extra scheduler was at least impliedly brought up, reasonably raised. And the first piece of evidence is the physician's, a DBQ that the physician had indicated on that he was unable to work. Now, doesn't that, if the DBQ talk also reflects that he has other issues, other disabilities that are not related to his gastritis, I mean, that are not service connected.
So that's, I think, correct, yeah.
Ulcers and let's see, what was the other one? Ulcers and.
I'm sorry, I do not recall at the moment.
Well, in any case, neither one of them were connected. Neither one of them were connected. So the DBQ is kind of not clear on which symptoms belong to which conditions. The other piece of evidence was that, the DBQ talked about abdominal pain that wasn't relieved by ulcer medication. And ulcers is the other condition. So, and the third piece of evidence was there was indications that he went to the emergency room for diarrhea, but which symptoms are related to his service-connected disability that would cause the court to think that it was reasonably raised because he had other disabilities that were not service-connected?
Well, Your Honor, that's where I believe the Secretary is incorrect in relying upon this court's decision in Long. The issue here is not whether the evidence establishes entitlement to a referral, but whether or not the board was required to address the question of whether or not a referral was reasonably raised by the evidence. And the difference is that that's a much lower threshold for establishing the reasonably raised, because obviously the criteria by the very nature is whether or not that evidence reasonably suggests that there would be a need for extra scheduler consideration. Not that there would be, but that there would be potentially a need. And that minimum threshold is met by the criteria set out in Berenger and in the three pieces of evidence, which the secretary has conceded constitute the issue having been reasonably raised. So we have to separate the threshold question of reasonably raised, which is at a lower threshold, from the question of entitlement to the referral as discussed by this court in Long.
Thank you.
Mr. Carpenter, doing a little riff on Judge Peach's question. So he has multiple gastrointestinal diagnoses, does he not?
He does.
And can you just, so those are the hiatal stomach hernia, the service-connected gastritis.
And the ulcers. Yes.
And GERD, or are you not considering that as part of this?
Well, I think
as part of this record, I should say.
Yeah. I agree with Judge Peach. It is very difficult to tell from the DBQ, as in my experience with all DBQs, what in particular is being looked at by the examiner, because it is more a function of checking boxes than it is a question of giving a report or evaluation of the conditions that are presented. But independent of that, it really doesn't make any difference that there are non-service-connected disabilities covered in the DBQ. The only relevant question here is whether or not, as a matter of law, the question of reasonably raised was presented by that evidence. And we suggest that it is a very low threshold for the mere possibility of extra scheduler consideration. And again, as this court said in Berenger, it's only for the purpose of the board making the determination of reasonably raised, not actually making or being required to make the referral.
Well, it would matter because he is apparently only service connected for the gastritis. And so in deciding whether the extra scheduler issue was reasonably raised, we wouldn't want you to be using evidence of a non-service symptoms of a non-service connected condition.
Of course not, Your Honor. But the point is that the legal test here is a low test, and the test is only that the question of entitlement to a referral is reasonably raised. And clearly, the secretary has already conceded this, but even if they hadn't conceded it, those three pieces of evidence meet that low threshold and demonstrate the clear error of law made by the board in this case, which requires a return to the board. If there's no further questions, I'll proceed to the remedy portion. Well, unless there are.
Mr. Carpenter, no. You also referenced, I believe it was in the supplemental, you referenced 38 CFR 4.114. The regulation under which the DCs, the gastrointestinal DCs, fall. You didn't argue for a higher scheduler eval in the initial brief, or were you by referencing 4.114? Were you attempting to raise a scheduler evaluation issue?
We are. I was only trying to respond to the questions that were presented in the supplemental briefing order. And it seems to me that the question that was raised in the supplemental briefing order that we attempted to address was the impact of the statement of direction that was provided in that diagnostic code relative to consideration of other diagnostic codes. We were not making an attempt to backdoor a scheduler increase under either diagnostic code, but merely demonstrate that the clear direction of the secretary was that other diagnostic codes had to be considered when there was, as in this case, overlapping symptomatology that were equally applicable, for instance, to the hiatal hernia.
Thank you.
Mr. Carpenter?
Yes, Your Honor.
Mr. Judge, in your question and answer with the Chief Judge, you mentioned briefly about TDIU as a possible schedule or alternative. Where in the briefing have you raised or your co-counsel raised specifics regarding schedule alternatives? There was a brief mention in the supplemental brief about words to the effect that it was evident that the board did not exhaust schedule alternatives, but where specifically has this issue been raised prior to today's oral argument?
Oh, no, Your Honor, I'm sorry, I believe I was misunderstood. If I was understood to say that the issue of TDIU was raised, I was not saying that at all. I was simply observing that had I been briefing this case in the original briefing, I would have briefed it under both 4.16 and 3.321 as having been reasonably raised.
But did you not have an opportunity, at least once you joined the appellant's team, which is 7 days after this was sent to panel, in order to raise specifics regarding alternative scheduler alternatives?
Certainly I did, Your Honor, but I didn't believe that that was appropriate given the original briefing that was done and given ultimately the supplemental briefing order that focused our attention directly on 3.321b1. I'm sorry, I probably should not have made that reference to the fact of what I might have done. What I might have done is not relevant to this argument. All that's relevant to this argument is whether or not the board failed as required under Berenger to have discussed and addressed. They neither discussed nor addressed whether or not the issue was reasonably raised. That is the simple end of the matter in terms of whether or not the board in this case did or did not make a clear error of law, which it did.
Okay, but you do acknowledge that your co-counsel has significant experience in veterans law, had the opportunity to raise, but did not raise in the briefing in the arguments.
TDIU, that would be correct, Your Honor.
Or other scheduler alternatives. It's not limited to TDIU. That was just the specific alternative that was mentioned. But
well, Your Honor, again, in response to the Chief's question, I was trying to address what was in the supplemental briefing order in terms of the statement that was made in the diagnostic code in the CFR. And in that reference, which was made in the supplemental briefing order, it referenced to whether or not there were overlapping symptoms that should be considered by the VA in rating the service-connected disability under a different, and we believe more favorable, diagnostic code, which would have given him a higher scheduler rating. But that was only in response to the question presented in the supplemental briefing order.
Thank you.
If I can proceed then to the question of remedy. We believe that the remedy for the board's failure to have recognized the extra scheduler consideration was reasonably raised is found in the unambiguous language of the amended provisions of the relevant regulation in this matter, which is 3.321b1. That language no longer suggests or even makes reference to a threshold determination for the referral to the decision maker. It says now that the director and only the director makes an extra scheduler determination. Furthermore, the phrase upon field station submission has been removed. Both this court and the Federal Circuit relied upon that language in both of their decisions in Thun to make a inference that there was some need for participation by either the regional office adjudicator or by the board in determining whether or not a referral should be made. Even in even the secretary, in a response to this court order, concedes that the regulation now only states that the director is authorized to approve an extra scheduler evaluation.
Mr. Carpenter, I'm sorry to interrupt you, but
that's all right.
How do you interpret the word or the phrase or designee? If you say only the director, but also there's that phrase or designee.
And I interpret that language to mean someone within the director's office. I do not interpret it as broadly as the government has to suggest that somehow it could be a delegation to the regional office adjudicator or to the board for that matter. Such an interpretation of that language is simply unreasonable on its face because it creates logistic nightmares. It's got to get to the decision maker. And the question is, how does it get to the decision maker? And the way,
Mr. Carpenter, your time is expiring. Judge Peach, would you like Mr. Carpenter to continue with that? And do you have further questions?
I do have one more question. Yes.
Okay. Okay. Ms. Brequet, would you add 5 minutes, please?
Mr. Carpenter, if you interpret the phrase or designee to mean somebody in the director's office, how do you envision it getting to the director's office? I mean, are you envisioning all cases go up to the referred automatically, or I mean, with no?
No, Your Honor, I rely on the plain language of the regulation, which says that these matters are to be dealt with by the director or the director's designee. I recognize that there is a clear gap in the regulatory language that now suggests how it gets there. And this case is a perfect example of how it should get there when it is reasonably raised by the evidence, or had Mr. Rivera Colon specifically raised a request for entitlement to reconsideration, then at that time, the matter should have been sent directly to the director's office. There is no need for a referral. The language of the regulation is clear. Only the director or his or her designees are able to make this decision. So it has to get to the place where the decision is made. And the only place where the decision is made is in the director's office.
Thank you. I don't have any further questions.
Okay. In our view, the secretary cannot. I'm sorry, Your Honor.
Laura, did you have further questions?
No, thank you, Chief.
Would you like me to finish the 3 minutes, Your Honor, or should I?
Well, you can sum up, Mr. Carpenter.
Oh, okay. I will sum up by suggesting that the decision in Thun and its progeny required this court to review decisions of the board, not to refer them. The amended language eliminates that necessity. We would urge the court to adopt the interpretation as proffered by Mr. Rivera-Colon find that clear error was made and direct the board to send this matter directly to the director. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you, Mr. Carpenter. And Mr. Garand, you may go ahead.
Thank you, Your Honor. Good afternoon, and may it please the court. My name is Carson Garand, and again with Christopher Wallace, Deputy Chief Counsel, we represent the Secretary of Veterans Affairs. We respectfully request that this court affirm the board's June 12, 2019 decision that denied entitlement to a rating in excess of 10% for appellant service-connected gastritis. The record did not reasonably raise the issue of referral for extra scheduler consideration such that the board needed to address this issue in its decision. First, it's appellant's burden to demonstrate that there's been prejudicial error or that the board's statement of reasons or bases is inadequate, but he has failed to do so here. For the record to reasonably raise the issue of referral for extra scheduler consideration, the record, a couple of pieces of evidence must be present. First, there must be evidence to suggest that appellant's disability picture is exceptional. And there must also be evidence that implicates Thune's second step regarding the functional effects of the exceptional disability picture. Appellant points to three pieces of evidence here, as Judge Peach identified, but he confuses the difference between functional impairments and functional effects. In Long, this court discussed the difference between the two, noting that functional impairments are related to Thune's first step and that functional effects are related to Thune's second step. The most common examples, of course, of functional effects are marked interference with employment and frequent periods of hospitalization. The primary piece of evidence appellant relies on here is an August 2018 private examination in which he stated to the examiner that he discontinued work due to his gastritis symptoms. Discontinuing work due to his gastritis symptoms is something that purely goes to the functional effects of his gastritis symptomatology and does not indicate or suggest that he has an exceptional disability picture. And I'll also note about this piece of information that the appellant, again, either he stated to the examiner or the examiner found that he discontinued work due to his symptoms, but the statement does not indicate why he was unable to work due to his gastritis symptoms or how those symptoms impacted his ability to work.
Mr. Guerin, let's step back a minute. I understand what you're saying about impairments versus effects, but let's put that aside for the minute. If, as you say, we don't consider the employment aspect at the first step, although I would note that Long talked about looking at the totality of the circumstances, and it seems like employment problems might be relevant there, but putting that aside even, did the board explain what typical and usual symptoms are of gastritis?
No, Your Honor, the board did not discuss this in its opinion or explain what that looked like. Again, this court in Doucette has explained that it's common sense essentially that a diagnostic code designed to assess a certain disability, and Doucette it was hearing loss, in this instance it was gastritis, of course, that reasonably contemplates those symptoms that are typically associated with gastritis.
Right, but Doucette was saying that in the context of what I think Doucette or one of the other cases called a mechanical application of the diagnostic code, meaning there were, evaluation is determined via the charts, et cetera. And so you don't have a list of symptoms. I think that was their point there.
Yes, Your Honor. Of course, respectfully, the Diagnostic Code 7307 similarly has objective standards that typically, that's the primary basis as to how somebody gets a veteran gets an elevated rating under the Diagnostic Code. And the symptoms, the and symptoms language is again similar to that in the, although the hearing loss diagnostic code does not have that and symptoms language, it's basically the and symptoms language in 7307 makes plain, again, kind of what this court has held, which is that, a diagnostic code meant to assess gastritis necessarily contemplates those symptoms that are typically associated with gastritis. Or here, for example, a 10% rating requires small nodular lesions and symptoms, and that and symptoms language just simply indicates that the symptoms must be relevant or what's typically associated with small nodular lesions. And so no, Your Honor, the board did not discuss exactly what those symptoms entail, but again, it's appellant's burden here to demonstrate that his disability picture is exceptional, and there's nothing in the record to indicate that his symptomatology is truly unusual or exceptional, such that referral for extra scheduler consideration is warranted.
And so whenever appellant was answering questions, I think Judge Peach and I focused on the fact that Mr. Rivera-Colon seems to have several gastrointestinal conditions, including GERD, but also the stomach hernia, the hiatal hernia, and ulcer, and perhaps there was one other. So there are several gastrointestinal conditions or diagnoses noted in the record here other than gastritis. Now, as far as your statement that typical symptom, like we don't have to have a list in the DC. That's your view, is that there's no list that's required. It's just whatever would typically be associated with gastritis. That's already kind of like, that's already under the gastritis umbrella, even though the DC isn't mentioning anything. So the fact, is it your position, like for the fact that he was vomiting, but not only vomiting, but vomiting blood? Like, so there's no distinction between that at all whenever we're whenever VA is evaluating gastritis.
Your Honor, and I'll make sure I clarify here that it's the typical symptoms associated with the relevant rating criteria in the diagnostic code. So it's not necessarily the typical symptoms associated with gastritis, but instead the symptoms that are typically associated with small nodular lesions, or for a 30% rating, the symptoms that are typically associated with multiple small eroded and ulcerated areas. So
what symptoms are associated with small nodular lesions?
Your Honor, there are a number of different things that the board can look to determine kind of what symptoms are associated with those different disability levels and those.
And did the board talk about those?
Your Honor, no, the board did not discuss that in its decision. But the board can certainly look to the examinations in the record, as this court discussed in Martinac, and I believe Judge Shulin mentioned in her dissent in Doucette, where the a adequate VA examination that fully discusses the functional impacts and effects of a veteran's disability is certainly something that the board can look to determine what level of disability or what rating is appropriate under a diagnostic code. And the board can, or the regional offices can also look to the DBQs of record, which again, the DBQs are a standard form that is used to assess and get and kind of determine the veteran's full disability picture to determine, what kind of those symptoms are and what the severity and the symptoms that he experiences due to the gastritis. So there are
two problems here. One is we don't know what symptoms are typical for gastritis, other than your statement that you just, I don't really know how to characterize what you're saying. Like we just know. but the other problem is the other, issue I'm having with what you're saying is that he had several different diagnoses, but it wasn't like the DBQ or the exams ever broke out. What are his symptoms that are related to gastritis? And what are symptoms related to his hernia or ulcers or the other gastro conditions that he has? So both of those things seem to me to be problematic.
Sure, Your Honor. I've not seen anything in the record, or appellant has not raised any argumentation, certainly, that nausea or vomiting or the abdominal pain is something that's not common to gastritis. And so I certainly understand your point, and the cues of record are certainly for stomach conditions as a whole, as opposed to something that's specifically for gastritis. But of course, 4.114 is the regulatory scheme for that regulation is one that allows for a single assignment under the predominant disability for symptoms that could be encompassed by multiple diagnostic codes. So Although the DBQs at issue do not specify, you know, what symptoms are exactly related to appellant's gastritis, for example, the August 2018 private examiner found that he had the small nodular lesions, and so I think it could be interpretive, of course, to that the symptoms as found in those DBQs are related to the small nodular lesions.
So are you saying that the symptoms that the appellant has are because he has small nodular lesions? And that if he had multiple small eroded or ulcerated areas, there would be different symptoms?
Your Honor, there would either be presumably different symptoms, or they would the symptoms that he has would be more severe. DBQs at issue specify, for example, the nausea and vomiting that he says that he has, and the DBQs at issue essentially say that he has mild nausea and vomiting, that it happens four or more times a year, but that it lasts less than a day at a time. And so the diagnostic code presumably would contemplate more severe symptoms, the more tissue and organ damage that existed. So if there were multiple small eroded and ulcerated areas, presumably he would have either more severe nausea, or he would have more severe vomiting, or more frequent nausea or vomiting that lasts a longer duration. Yes, Your Honor, and there may be also different symptoms associated with that, presumably symptoms that would be contemplated by the DBQs and would be listed in the VA examinations of record.
And again, as was indicated earlier, is that the DBQ does list a lot of symptoms, but I'm not sure what they relate to, which disorder or disability he has it relates to. And, if the difference between having 10 and 30% deals with it rests on whether he has small nodular lesions and symptoms, or whether he has multiple small eroded or ulcerated areas and symptoms, how am I to know what symptoms there are that would relate to that tissue condition?
Your Honor, the DBQs at issue do not specify that, but again, it would be looking at the examinations of record, again, that are adequate and fully discuss the functional effects of appellant's gastritis, and then looking at the DBQs, if there was the objective finding of multiple small eroded and ulcerated areas, then at that point, you would ideally see or presumably see an increase in the duration and frequency of the symptoms. But again, the symptoms that are found here and that the record indicates appellant has are at the low end of or the minor duration and frequency, which again kind of makes sense with the 10% rating that he currently has.
Thank you. I have no further follow-on questions.
Thank you, Judge Peach. Your Honors, appellant's disability picture here, contrary, of course, to what opposing counsel and appellant are asserting, the Secretary has not conceded that the record reasonably raised the issue of referral for extra scheduler consideration. The two of the three pieces of evidence that appellant cites to go primarily to the functional effects of his gastritis symptomatology and do not suggest that his gastritis symptomatology and disability picture is exceptional. And then he also mentions a finding by the August 2018 private examiner that his abdominal pain was unrelieved by standard ulcer therapy. This finding was made by that examiner in the context of determining the severity of his abdominal pain, but appellant has not advanced any argument to suggest that that finding of severity indicates that his disability picture is exceptional, such that the record would reasonably raise this issue.
Now, Mr. Guerin, now let's address this issue that you raised, that his discontinuance of employment due to his gastritis, as referenced on the DBQ form, I believe, it does not go to the first step of Thune, but instead goes to the second step of Thune. Now, in Berenger, in order to, I think Mr. Carpenter's point was that we're not, whenever we're looking at whether extra scheduler was reasonably raised, we're not limited by the Thune, framework. But also in Berenger, didn't this court find that the veteran's inability to work due to service-connected condition was a factor in determining whether extra scheduler was reasonably raised?
Yes, Your Honor, that is certainly a factor to consider. But as this court's, and I certainly understand, and as Mr. Carpenter mentioned, the appellant does not have to not need to demonstrate exceptionality, or that both the full extent of Thune's analysis has been met. I mentioned previously, it's just that the record suggests that he has an exceptional disability picture, or that, and then some evidence implicating Thune's second step. And so again, this, it's not the secretary's position that the Thune analysis must be met simply for the record to reasonably raise referral for extra scheduler consideration. Your Honor, certainly the August 2018 private examination is relevant in this context. And again, as to Thune's second step, but there, the threshold inquiry in Thune, again, which informs the analysis as to whether or not the record reasonably raised referral for extra scheduler consideration, requires some evidence to suggest that there's an exceptional disability picture. An appellant has failed to do so here. He stated in his brief that the August 2018 private examiner, that statement to the examiner or the examiner's finding indicated that his gastritis symptomatology was so severe that he could not work. But the record describes his gastritis symptomatology in detail, including the nausea and the vomiting and the abdominal pain. All of the other VA examiners in the record, all the other examiners found that appellant's symptomatology was not severe. They all found that he did not have, the other three VA examiners found that he did not have incapacitating episodes, or that his gastritis symptoms affected his ability to work. And it also detailed the severity of his nausea and vomiting, namely that it occurred four more times a year, that it was mild, and that it lasted for less than a day. So we know what the severity and the frequency and the duration of his gastritis symptoms are, namely, again, the nausea and the vomiting, and there's nothing there to indicate or suggest that his disability picture is exceptional.
Well, I'm finding it hard to tell from what you just said. I mean, if the doctors talked about certain symptoms, we don't really know that these symptoms are the ones covered under the DC, but it did look as though that the 2014 and 2016 examiners found symptoms were not severe, but a 2018, 2 years later, essentially, 2018 doctor found that the symptoms were severe and included like 20 pounds of weight loss. I mean, is it possible that, although if all we had on record were the first two exams, which are quite old now, that we might find that extra scheduler was not reasonably raised, but that the 22 exam, it looks as though his condition is somehow worse, and that the evidence from the 2018 exam would raise, or at least the board did not address why it wouldn't have raised the extra scheduler issue.
Yes, Your Honor, and I apologize if I misstated. I know the board mentioned that the, I believe it was the August 2018, one of those examinations, either the private or the VA exam, noted that he had severe symptoms, but that if you look at the actual examination themselves, all the examiners found that his symptoms were not severe. And so, again, certainly looking at the disability picture as a whole, there's nothing to indicate that his disability picture is exceptional such that the record reasonably raised the issue. And again, appellant has not advanced any argument as to why the pieces of evidence he identifies reasonably raises the record and suggests that his disability picture is exceptional. And he, again, as I mentioned, a couple of the pieces of evidence go to functional effects, which are typically included in the second part of that analysis. Again, although as you mentioned, Chief Judge, there may be some overlap there in terms of severity and whether or not that implicates the first step. But again, the evidence of record does not show that his disability picture is exceptional. And again, ultimately it's appellant's burden to demonstrate that the board statement of reasons or bases is inadequate and that the record did suggest that his disability picture was exceptional.
And the getting to the change in 3.321B, I had thought after reading the Federal Register when this was changed that the VA intended to delegate these decisions to RO adjudicators. And as you cite to the manual, funnily enough, because of course it's not binding, but you cite to the manual and say, well, no, you know, no, we're still doing the same thing that we did. Do you have any insight into what, I thought that the rule was changed. I thought the Federal Register indicated at one point that the change was to, make the process simpler. And it doesn't, why is VA not moving on this?
Your Honor, I think you're correct. The final rule there demonstrates that the language upon field station submission and referred was removed ultimately with the idea that the regional office would, or the director would delegate to the regional office the authority to award an extra scheduler rating instead of simply referring it to the director for the director to make that finding. And that was the primary impetus behind removing that language, not that it would change the referral process. Your Honor, I'm not exactly sure why VA has not at this point, or the director at this point has not delegated his or her authority to the regional offices so that they can award that in the first instance or an extra scheduler rating in the first instance. But I know based off the final rule and the comments contained therein that the intent of the removal of that language was not to change the referral process, but to just leave the door open at some point when the director decides to, if he does, to delegate that to the regional offices. And I'll also note as well, Your Honor, of course, the M21 is not precedential or is not binding on this court, of course, but it's just something else to look at to show that the intent behind the amendment in 2017 was not to change the referral process and to change that aspect of it, but really, again, just to first, of course, to go to reinstate this court's pre-Johnson versus McDonald law regarding the combined effects of disabilities. But then also to allow the director at some point to delegate that to the regional offices. And Your Honor, of course, I'm not exactly sure why that hasn't happened or when that would happen, if ever. But that was the intent behind the amendment, not to change the referral process at all. And of course, as this court has mentioned recently, Long versus Wilkie, and then in a non-precedential opinion that we cited to in our brief, I believe Reeves versus McDonough, again, indicates that although this amendment occurred, it was not to to change the referral process.
Chief, may I? You said it was not the intent to change the referral process, but you said that it at some point the director could delegate to the RO to make those decisions in the first instance. Is that what I heard you say?
Yes, Your Honor, and let me make sure I clarify, of course, because you're correct there, that the intent at the time of the 2017 amendment, the removal of that language was not to change the referral process, but at some point in the future, if the director chose to delegate the authority to award an extra scheduler rating, then of course the referral process would be changed at that point, because it would be the regional offices who were making that that ultimate finding and decision. But again, that has not happened yet. And until if and when the director decides to delegate that authority, then of course the referral process would be changed, but that has not happened at this time.
Thank you.
And Your Honor's out.
Oh, Mr. Guerin, yes. So I'm still having trouble with this DC and the fact that it does not define symptoms, nor does it define the severity of symptoms in terms of moving up the ladder of evaluations. And, you know, we have case law that says that we can't accept as rationale for board decisions, because I say so, like, that's not a valid reason for the board to give. But here, like, I don't understand how we don't have any symptoms listed under the diagnostic code other than the kind of nodules. But in far as the word symptoms, we don't have any definition of what that means. There's no scope there. There's no severity of symptoms as you go up. Like, there's nothing to indicate what any of this means. So why shouldn't we find that this is another one of those cases where the board has simply said, yeah, you only deserve a 10% because I say so?
Yes, Your Honor, I certainly understand your point. And the diagnostic code certainly does not list the symptoms or explain what those symptoms are that are related to the objective, you know, again, the small nodular lesions or the multiple small eroded and ulcerated areas. Again, I think the idea is that whatever the symptoms that are present typically and usually are those symptoms that will be related to the objective findings in that case. Again, and this is, you know, instead of listing the specific symptoms, this is a relatively veteran friendly and flexible approach. So instead of saying, you know, there must be small nodular lesions and this, you know, express list of symptoms that must be met, as long as there is symptomatology related to that the small nodular lesions, a 10% rating would be appropriate. And then as long as there's the objective criteria for a 30% rating, the small eroded, multiple small eroded ulcerated areas, and then symptoms associated with that, a 30% rating would be appropriate in that context. So yeah, of course, Your Honor, I understand that it's tough to differentiate between what symptoms are associated with which level, but the diagnostic code in this instance is created, or it's written in a way so that the symptoms should essentially follow the objective criteria. And if there are objective criteria, or if the record demonstrates in some way that the symptoms that appellant experiences is out of whack or not normal with the, or not the typical symptoms associated with, for example, small nodular lesions, then a elevated a rating may be appropriate at that time.
Dawn, would you please add another 2 minutes? So, Mr. Guerin, so I'm going back to this this vomiting and the type of vomiting that someone is experiencing. So in the secretary's view, whether someone is vomiting food from the gastritis, or whether they're vomiting blood, either one could be associated with the type of nodules that Mr. Rivera-Colon has. There's no distinction. And if you're vomiting, four times a week versus twice a week, it really all depends on the nodules that you have there, and not so that really, as long as someone has only the 10% type of nodules, then whatever symptoms they have with whatever severity or frequency would be covered in the Secretary's view.
Your Honor, again, it's the Secretary's position that it's those symptoms that are typically associated with small nodular lesions. And so if that's vomiting simply food or vomiting blood, if that's the symptoms that are typically associated with that level of tissue damage, then yes, Your Honor, that it's the symptoms that are typically associated with that level of damage. And if there's something in the record to indicate that a higher level of severity of symptoms is present, certainly there could be elevations to the 30% level, because it indicates more significant tissue damage than the objective tests are demonstrating. And Your Honor, I see I'm about to run out of time. I'm happy to continue answering questions, or if you'd like, I can briefly conclude.
Yes, Judge Peach, do you have a further question or two?
Yes, I do, Chief. Thank you.
Ms. Briquet, would you add 3 minutes, please?
Thank you. Counsel, under the gastritis rating schedule here, we talked about the 10%. You would get 10% if you had certain tissue damage, small modular lesions and symptoms. Then you'd get 30% if you had multiple small eroded or ulcerated with symptoms, but you'd get 60%, and it says chronic with severe hemorrhaging, or large ulcerated or eroded areas. So what's that mean, chronic? What symptoms, I don't understand that.
Your Honor, and give me one second here. I believe the chronic gastritis is something that's anticipated by each level of disability. So both the 10%, 30%, and 60% level states that the gastritis must be chronic.
Oh, it must be chronic. I see. I'm sorry. My mistake. Yes.
No, no problem at all. And so, of course, I'm not a medical professional, whatever chronic means in that context, but it must be present for each of the three disability levels.
But then I guess what confused me is on 60%, they don't have end symptoms. So it's just a severe, it says severe hemorrhages or large ulcerated or eroded areas, but they deleted the phrase end symptoms. Can you enlighten me, or why would that be?
Yes, Your Honor. Respectfully, I don't think it was ever deleted. As far as I know, that the and symptoms language was not included at that 60% level. But again, Your Honor, it goes essentially to what I was saying earlier, which is that the and symptoms language is either somewhat redundant, or the diagnostic code is perhaps not the best written code, in terms of clarity. But if there's severe hemorrhaging and large ulcerated areas, I would imagine that there will be some type of symptomatology associated with that. And of course, the rating schedule as a whole is meant to compensate veterans for the average impairment in earning capacity. So while there is no and symptoms language there, it's the Secretary's position that again, the symptoms, it's that that level of disability and that level of tissue damage, it's included in that the typical symptoms associated with the severe hemorrhages, again, kind of the same way as the and symptoms language is at the 10 and 30% level.
Thank you. I have no follow-up.
Thank you, Your Honors.
Oh, Judge Lara, did you have any questions?
I have a question for Mr. Guerin, and that is, did the board comply with Morgan here and exhaust all the tools for rating appellants' gastritis? What's the secretary's position on?
Your Honor, the secretary's position that again, the record did not reasonably raise whether extra scheduler consideration was warranted, and that the available scheduler tools are adequate to compensate appellant for his gastritis symptomatology. The board discussed ratings under multiple diagnostic codes, and so it's the secretary's position that the secretary did exhaust the relevant scheduler criteria.
Thank you, Mr. Guerrand.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Mr. Carpenter, you may move ahead with rebuttal.
Okay, please, the court. I really only have one area that I'd like to pursue on rebuttal, and that deals with the question of the language of the amended provisions of 3.321b1. The government seems to assert that this court can rely upon the VA's manual provision, can rely upon the comments made in the Federal Register as a basis for interpreting the unambiguous language of this regulation. We do not believe that that is the legal standard for regulatory interpretation. Mr. Rivera-Colon specifically asserts that this court must interpret the amended language of 3.321b1 in order to determine the appropriate remedy in this case, and that there is nothing in the plain language that supports an intent to continue the referral process. If anything, the plain language supports the opposite conclusion, and that the intent of the secretary is not expressed by what is outside of the plain language used by the secretary in his regulation. The rules of regulatory interpretation require this court to focus directly upon the language used by the secretary. What did the secretary say, and what did he mean by what he said? And what the secretary said clearly was that there is only one decision maker, and that is the director. All of this discussion about what the director might do in terms of referral is not appropriate to determining what the regulation says. The regulation says that the director and only the director or his or her designee will be responsible for making the determination of extra scheduler. We believe on that basis, this court should find that the holdings in both of the Thun decisions of this court and the Federal Circuit are no longer applicable to the language in the amended regulation, and that the amended regulation simply requires that the issues when raised by a claimant or when reasonably raised by the evidence be directed to the director's office for a decision. Unless there's further questions, I would submit the matter. Thank you, Your Honors.
Judge Peach, do you have any further questions? And Judge Lara, do you have further questions?
No, thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Carpenter. And the court thanks both of you very much for your arguments. The case is submitted for consideration and the court is adjourned. Thank you.
Gordon is now in recess.